Congratulations to Esther Duflo, Abhijit Banerjee, and Michael Kremer on being awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences.
Duflo, Banerjee, and Kremer studied the poor not as cartoon characters, but as human beings in all their complexity and richness.
Around the world, hundreds of millions of people's lives have been measurably improved thanks to the efforts of the three Nobel laureates.
This week, a special Christmas edition of Vox Talks. In 2019, the economics world was delighted when the randomistas won the Nobel. But are we giving too much attention to RCTs? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every year, the announcement of the Nobel laureates in economics kicks up some controversy. But this year, Esther Duflo, Abhijit Banerjee and Michael Kremer initially did the impossible in the profession. They united economists in praise of their pioneering work in the field of randomized controlled trials, RCTs, of economic policies in developing countries. But if you look hard enough, there are always dissenting voices.
Hello, Lance. It's Tim Phillips from Vox Talks.
Hey, Tim.
Prominent among them this time, Lant Pritchett of Harvard University and the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. In a post that he wrote on Facebook soon after the Nobel announcement, he wrote that people keep saying that the recent Nobelists studied global poverty. This is exactly wrong. They made a commitment to a method, not a subject, and a commitment to method prevented them from studying global poverty. Now, Lant's post stirred up quite a response, most of it disagreeing strongly with him. So I thought I'd call him to find out if he really thought that development economists should be giving much less attention to targeted anti-poverty programs and much more, as he argued in his post, to raising the level of medium income.
Absolutely. If one looks across countries, what are the countries that have low poverty and what are the countries that have high poverty? Correlation between median income, the income of the typical person, and the poverty rate in the country is 0.99. That means everything else, measurement error, poverty programs, distribution of income independent of poverty programs, accounts for less than 1% of the variation of why countries have high poverty and why countries have low poverty. And the same, by the way, is true in changes. If one says what countries have reduced poverty and what countries have not reduced poverty, the countries where median income went up reduced poverty, the countries where median income didn't reduce poverty. So the data sort of says, in practice in the world today, the answer to why some countries have high poverty is all about median income. It's not like 50-50, 25-75, it's 0-100.
So if it's not making much of a difference, why is there such a focus on these targeted programs and these randomized controlled trials at the moment?
I think one of the important reasons is the advent of philanthropy. And the philanthropists came along and they asked two questions. What can I do to reduce poverty? And what can I do to reduce poverty without changing median income so that I directly get credit for it? What can I be seen as doing for poverty for which I get credit is not the same question as what can I do to reduce poverty. The randomized controlled trials provide an answer to super rich philanthropists of how they should devote their tiny little pots of money in the grand scheme of things to direct poverty action. Doing better rather than worse, more effective rather than less effective poverty programs makes a ton of sense. But that doesn't make it an important question for the world, for the government of India, for the government of Egypt, for the government of Tanzania. Doesn't make it an important question for the World Bank, which presumably is trying to help develop countries as opposed to just devote marginal amounts of money to charity work.
Surely one of the other problems as well is that we don't know very well exactly what is going to create this growth.
I think that's an argument for more research rather than less research. The growth acceleration that happened in India around the early 1990s, I've done a paper that calculated the net present value of the gain to GDP in India from that growth acceleration, and it's about $3 trillion. The gains to China's growth from its growth accelerations, is $11 trillion. If I told you there's $11 trillion to be had, but I'm not quite sure how to do it, one wouldn't say, well, I don't want to devote any time and attention to that. You'd say, oh my gosh, this is a really important and pressing research question.
Now, a lot of people paid attention to these opinions of yours straight after the Nobel Prizes were awarded this year. You had an opinion on that. But this isn't a recent opinion for you?
No, no. I've been writing papers along these lines for some time. I completed a paper in June of 2019, well in advance of there being even any inkling the Swedes would go this way, making exactly these arguments. So this has been an ongoing debate I have had with the randomistas, many of whom I was early supporters of and remain friends with. While I was at the World Bank, it turns out, perhaps ironically, I was actually the task team leader of one of Michael Kramer's first randomized controlled trials. So this is ongoing debate we have been having for over 20 years. This is not some knee-jerk reaction.
Is there room in the academy for both growth theorists and randomistas?
Absolutely. This isn't a question that nothing can be learned from RCTs. It's just, I think the pendulum swung from doing way too few randomized controlled trials way too far to the other side.
Lant's arguments reminded me of an interview that I had done in summer 2019 for our companion podcast, Vox Dev Talks, published by voxdev.org. I had spoken to Bill Easterly, the co-director of NYU's Development Research Institute. Bill is well known for challenging the conventional wisdom, and he was arguing that the focus of development economics on RCTs, which was intended to catch the attention of policymakers, actually meant that economics was losing its impact on policy.
I see most of the academic development literature is concentrating on randomized controlled trials and, you know, small development interventions that can be tested with randomized controlled trials. That's the sense in which I think there's not enough research on these kind of big picture policies. I think the policymakers are not as interested in randomized controlled trials as the researchers are. They see all this development research being produced on really small programs that policymakers are not that interested in. Policymakers want things that have substantial effects on development prospects, and you're not going to get that from some program to improve teacher attendance in schools through taking photographs of the teachers. They probably would like things that have much bigger effects on economic growth and development, and we're currently not really doing much research that would be useful to them in that area.
So, has development economics become too focused on RCTs, and is it losing policy relevance as a result?
Hello there.
Hello, Ariana.
Hi.
To get an opinion from someone who's in the front line of both RCT-based research and who's worked for many years to turn that research into policies and economic growth, I visited Oriana Bandiera. Among other things, she's Director of State Capabilities at the International Growth Centre based at the London School of Economics and co-director of the Development Research Programme at the Centre for Economic Policy Research.
First of all, Oriana, for the Nobel Award this year, do you feel that it went to the right people?
So that's always a very difficult question to answer because you have to consider all the people that it could have gone to. Maybe a question I can answer is whether I think these people deserved it. And my answer is most definitely yes. And the main reason why I think that is because they changed the way economies do things. For a long time, development was kind of the embarrassing cousin of economics. You know, people who did field work were looked down at like, you know, somebody who's too weird to be seen in polite society with. They brought it into the mainstream. They got economists out of their offices, onto the field, working with policymakers. And I think that that's a very good thing.
But do you accept Lant's criticism that we should really be focusing more on raising median income and that is the thing that lifts people out of poverty?
I'm not quite sure that's right, because India's been growing a lot to the point that it's not a developing country anymore, according to the DFID. And yet there are very many millions of people below the poverty line in India. So I think the two approaches are highly complementary. In my recent research, we found strong evidence of poverty traps. If there are poverty traps, growth is not going to take you very far. So I think both issues are important. I don't think we should do one at the expense of the other.
And do you think that there's enough room in economics departments for growth theory and
Certainly.
Yeah.
Most certainly. The Nobel laureates themselves, they made great contribution to macro theory. Michael Kremer was a theorist to start with, and so was Abhijit. And especially Michael did a lot for growth theory. So I think, you know, that's not why they got the prize, but they both integrate the both approaches.
Now let's turn to what Bill Easterly was talking to me about. One of the things he said is that policymakers are not very interested in the results of RCTs. They're looking at bigger things. Is that a criticism that you recognize? You've dealt a lot with policymakers.
So I think that's a much more stinging criticism, because I think it's probably true that in most cases, policymakers are not involved. Not in the case of the three Nobel laureates, because their experiments had very big impact. And they estimate that they reached many millions of people thanks to the results of their RCTs. But there are many experiments which are done in isolation by researchers, and policymakers are not involved. And obviously, if they're not involved, they're not going to take up. So I think that's a problem on the way that researchers organize the research. There should be a lot more a cogeneration of research rather than researchers coming up with ideas and trying to impose them on policymakers. So when that happens, it's clearly not worth it.
One of the points that Lamp made was that NGOs, people who are funding this research, really rather like to be tied to it. When it becomes policy, it's taken away from them.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I think that the collaboration of research with policymakers, that's what produces the best thing. When the demand comes from the policymaker, then they own the results. And I think the RCTs have done a lot into bringing researchers and policymakers a lot closer together. Of course, there's much more to be done.
One of the things that Bill said in the full interview that I did with him as well is that if you are a young researcher now or a PhD candidate, then the best way to advance your career in development economics is to be involved with RCTs. He wouldn't recommend thinking about growth in its biggest terms as a way to start your career. Again, do you think that that's a reasonable criticism?
I have a slightly different perspective on this. I think that was never actually true. If I think in the past 10 years, the students that we have produced from the LSE, from development, I would say about half of them were doing RCTs. And actually, some of the most successful ones, those who got jobs at MIT, weren't. And they got jobs at MIT. That's where Esther and Abhijit are.
But although Oriana disagrees strongly with Lant's argument that the pendulum has swung way too far, she does see a split in the profession. But for her, it's not inside economics departments. It's between academic economists and policymakers.
People always tend to see divisions. I think we are a lot more united than it seems. What the true division is between practitioners and economists. And that's the gulf that we have to fill. So the collaboration with policymakers, that's what we have to do best. But I don't think there is much schism within the discipline. At least I don't see it.
And to improve that collaboration between researchers and policymakers.
So I think that's a matter of institution building. And actually, Michael Kremer and the other two laureates have done quite a lot in trying to bring these two things together. The IGC at the London School of Economics does a lot to do that. But I think there is much more to be done. We should have, for instance, courses in PhD programs that train researchers on how to interact with policymakers and how to co-generate knowledge. And we don't have that. Actually, I say that, but at the LSE, we just started one. We're just piloting one as we speak.
How's it going?
It's going fantastically well. There's a lot of interest. It's a school-wide course. So hopefully that will be followed. I think we need a lot more of that.
That's it for Box Talks in 2019. We hope you've enjoyed our episodes this year. If you missed any, there are two ways to catch up. At first, you'll find Box Talks on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, TuneIn, pretty much every podcast platform. So subscribe and you'll get a reminder every week. Or over the holidays, why not spend a few hours at foxeu.org/vox-talks catching up on the archives. We'll be back on the 10th of January 2020 with the first Vox Talk of the year. If there is anything you would like us to investigate or you want to hear about, please let us know.